is useless to resist us.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Our friend and colleague, the frequent filer under the Freedom of Information Act, Jason Leopold, is testifying before Congress as I record this podcast. Jason has been a longtime contributor to my radio broadcasts and these podcasts, now entering our sixth year. And he has used the Freedom of Information Act very effectively. And it has led to his breaking many significant stories over the last 10-plus years. And today he gets a rare opportunity to testify before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, chaired by Republican Jason Chaffetz. And I've read Jason's prepared remarks. As you know, when you testify before a committee, you prepare remarks and you submit them. You don't always get to deliver them. Often they just take them under advisement, they ask a couple of questions, and depending on who actually attends the committee hearing and how much they care about the issue before that committee at the moment, the hearings can be very brief and kind of rote, or they can be fascinating, where testimony is brought forward that really engages the witness and brings out new information. So in his prepared statement, Leopold says, "I have submitted thousands of FOIA requests to dozens of different agencies, and in my experience, fewer than 1% of my requests have been decided within the time frame required by the FOIA law." And his most recent example is after President Obama nominated Loretta Lynch to serve as the Attorney General. The next day, Leopold filed FOIA requests for information about her work as a federal prosecutor in New York. And just to cut the story short, he still hasn't received that information long after her protracted delayed confirmation has occurred. And that's in direct violation of the law, but the bureaucrats have all kinds of defenses and dodges that they use. And it'll be interesting to see if Jason Leopold's testimony is taken seriously, and if they really do engage him, as I described a moment ago. Well, meanwhile, across the rotunda at the U.S. Capitol, in the Senate chambers, the effort to put the genie back in the bottle, the toothpaste back in the tube, to restore the Patriot Act to its full luster as it existed on Sunday, before that demon Rand Paul blocked action in the Senate, well, it's taken a new twist. Mitch McConnell, who misjudged his chamber and obviously botched his effort to pass a full renewal of the Patriot Act with zero amendments, has thrown another curveball to his members. And as you know, when the Senate passes a bill and the House has a bill on the same subject, if the terms are not nearly identical, then the bill goes to a conference committee. And that can be a lengthy process where they hammer out the differences between the two versions, and then each chamber has to vote again on the compromise reached in the conference. Bottom line, that takes time. And Mitch McConnell has infuriated members of the Senate who were pretty much willing to go along with him to pass the House version of the USA Freedom Bill. But now McConnell wants to amend out language in the House bill that would require the FISA court to release most of its rulings. McConnell says that this is discreet and sensible change. But this is restoring full secrecy to the secret court that has no place in the American system. And this is one of the minor gains of the House USA Freedom Act. It also requires an advocate for you and me in the FISA court. I don't think that's terribly meaningful, but it's better than what we've had. And so now McConnell has roiled both members of the House and the Senate by trying to push this through. Ron Wyden from Oregon says, "You're talking about going back to secret law. That would be a huge mistake. This is an extraordinarily important issue." And so what we thought was going to be a quick kind of rubber stamp designed to keep the telephone metadata collection program going, despite the fact that it hasn't been useful in any meaningful way. And, of course, we hear these calls from members of Congress that America's not safe right now until we restore these provisions that haven't been used, the lone wolf and the roving wiretap provisions. I mean, it's really a senseless debate that is underway. And as we'll get to in just a moment, there are surveillance systems that are untouched by any of the so-called drama and so-called reform that we're seeing in Washington right now. So Rand Paul's allies, including some Democrats, are not going to stop here, and I'm glad to report this to you. Tom Massey is a Republican member of the House from Kentucky, an ally of Rand Paul's. He has submitted an amendment to a forthcoming appropriations bill to block any funding for the National Institute of Science and Technology to coordinate or consult with the NSA or the CIA for the purpose of establishing cryptographic or computer standards that permit the warrantless electronic surveillance by the spy agencies. And Zoe Lofgren, who is a trained lawyer and a member of the House from San Jose, Silicon Valley, she's a Democrat, she is co-sponsoring this amendment with Massey. And they're going to place it on a series of must-pass bills, like the funding for the Justice Department, until they can get it approved. Lofgren is also working with a different Republican, Ted Poe of Texas, and they're going to propose an amendment to the same appropriations bill that would block the FBI from inserting vulnerabilities into encryption on mobile devices. Now, these are interesting efforts, and I support all of them. Any restoration of our Fourth Amendment rights is good for me, and that's what I want to see. But as I mentioned, these efforts that we're seeing so much coverage and so much drama derived from are just nibbling around the edges. They're throwing under the bus elements of the surveillance state that don't work and aren't needed, while they say, oh, we can't lose these, we must have them, these are essential to our security, and this is all a big sideshow, intending to distract us, for example, from the fact that the FBI has a fleet of 115 small aircraft that have been seen flying over urban areas. They are equipped with video and cell phone surveillance technology. They're hidden behind fictitious companies that lease the planes to the FBI. And no warrants are sought for the surveillance that these aircraft are conducting. The Associated Press deserves credit for breaking this story. After all, the Justice Department tapped their phones last year, and it's amazing that they can get sources to tell them things like this. And last week, if you recall, I released an in-depth interview with reporter Allie Winston from the Center for Investigative Reporting about the use of devices in Oakland that fall under the brand of Stingray. And these are the cell phone simulators that cause cell phones within a two-mile radius to check in and dump all of their information, not just the phone number. No. A lot more information than that. And Allie Winston told us about the dirt boxes made by a company called DRT. And dirt boxes are placed in aircraft that hover over an area. We know they've been used at airports. And they suck up all of the cell phone data, including potentially live phone calls that are underway at that time. They suck them up. And the people who are surveilled in this manner have no idea whatsoever that it's going on. Now, it amazes me that the FBI can get clearance from the FAA to fly a Cessna over a commercial airport in order to conduct this kind of surveillance. In a recent 30-day period, AP says the FBI flew above more than 30 cities in 11 states. They have 115 planes, at least. And the AP traced at least 50 aircraft back to the FBI, identifying more than 100 flights just since late April, orbiting both major cities and rural areas. This program, unaffected by any of the discussion or the legislation in Washington today. And that's just one example. As I've explained, the PRISM program that intercepts all of our internet traffic, it's going full bore. All the other programs that, what was X key score that Ed Snowden revealed, untouched by any of this. And yet we're told to cower and be afraid because the national security state is not operating at 100% today. It's bullshit. Meanwhile, the airport security theater that I have been critical of for so long just was subjected to red team inspections. This is where the government has designated people on a red team, and they are told to go through a security checkpoint with a weapon. And the failure rate of the TSA is 95%. 67 of 70 tests were flunked by the TSA. And meanwhile, grandmothers get groped, nursing mothers get humiliated. There's, you know, some relief now. We don't all have to take our shoes and belts off every time. And I actually think that kind of randomness probably makes some sense. But the whole thing is a charade. We haven't intercepted a single terrorist at an airport since 9/11 that I know of. And yet we squander billions of dollars, we waste people's time, and as I've told you before, I believe that the airports are the scene where they're injecting fear into the American public on a daily basis. And I don't know about you, but I've had enough. And I'd love to see our government actually roll back some of these useless security and surveillance programs. But I appear to be a lone wolf in pursuing that goal. Well, every day I pause here to thank people who support my work with your subscriptions. Tom Burkhart just recently canceled his monthly subscription and upped to an annual subscription. Gary Washington's been on board for many years. Julie Dupree, Steve Lane, they are monthly subscribers, and I really appreciate each and every one of you. So if you're not a subscriber, I could really use your support. It's a struggle to keep all this going, cover my bills, and do the other work that I need to do so I have time to bring you a podcast every day. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture, you click the link that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget, or our best deal, that $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers get an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. That's my bonus gift. A couple of breaking stories. This is not a surprise. Today in Zurich, at a hastily called news conference, FIFA President Sepp Blatter announced he will resign, but it's going to be a while. 3 or 4 months until they can call an extraordinary Congress to elect a new leader. Now, they just re-elected Sepp Blatter last Friday. And so this does appear to be a diversionary tactic to buy some time, but I guess that Blatter will be going. And what appeared to push him over the edge was Monday, the report that FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valcke, Blatter's right-hand man, is connected to a $10 million payment sent to former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner in exchange for what prosecutors say was a positive vote on South Africa's bid for the 2010 World Cup. Another breaking story from Boston today that brings back ugly memories from the killing of Ibrahim Todashev. Todashev was somehow linked to the Tsarnaev brothers. He was living in Florida. He was being interrogated by an FBI agent, witnessed by two members of the Massachusetts State Patrol. And we're told that Todashev, while being asked to write out a confession-type statement, ended up charging at the FBI agent. We're told he flipped a table on the guy, then we're told he grabbed a lamppost, then we're told he had some kind of a spear or a broomstick. In any event, the FBI agent shot and killed Ibrahim Todashev, and the FBI investigated the FBI and declared that it was all okay. So today in Boston, the reports are sketchy so far, but an armed man in his 20s, described as Middle Eastern, who is being tailed and surveilled by the FBI counterterrorism unit, was shot and killed. Here's the account from Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. He was on foot under surveillance. The officers had been surveilling him, and again, they wanted to speak to him. And he turned, and our officers gave several commands for him to drop the weapon, and unfortunately, he came at the officers, and they did what they were trained to do, and that's never an easy decision for an officer to make. One FBI agent and one Boston cop fired. The suspect reportedly was wielding a large military-style black knife that could have, quote, done a lot of damage. Now, isn't this a replay of the script from the Todashev killing? This one's on the street. This time it's a military-style black knife. That may or may not be true. Often these early accounts of a story get key information wrong because it's supplied from a single source, the police department or the FBI. So we'll continue to monitor this. They haven't named the individual who was shot and killed, but I am immediately skeptical. We've gotten more confirmed information about the abuse of Majid Khan, who remains at Guantanamo Bay. He's been in American custody for many years now. And based on statements that have been permitted or cleared by the government for release, 27 pages of interview notes compiled by his lawyers over the last 7 years, which have been released today. And we learned that the CIA used a wider array of sexual abuse and other forms of torture than was disclosed in the Senate report released last December. Khan said interrogators poured ice water on his genitals, videotaped him naked, repeatedly touched his private parts, none of which was described in the Senate report. Interrogators, some of whom smelled of alcohol, also threatened to beat him with a hammer, baseball bat, sticks, leather belts. And Khan, age 35, is a Pakistani citizen. He went to high school in Maryland. And he's awaiting sentencing because he decided the only way out was to plead guilty. So he took a guilty plea in 2012 to conspiracy, material support, murder, and spying, and it's expected that he'll get 19 years in prison, 19 years from starting in 2012. So that would end up being somewhere around 29 to 32 years in American custody. What he confessed to, delivering $50,000 to al-Qaeda operatives in Indonesia, and the money was used for the bombing of a Marriott hotel in Jakarta, and that was in 2003. Now, this sounds like an admission to things that he didn't actually do, but I can't really adjudicate that from here. Khan told his lawyers, "I wish they had killed me." One CIA agent said to him, "Son, we're going to take care of you. We're going to send you to a place that you cannot imagine." And Khan, when he went on a hunger strike, was one of the people subjected to forced rectal feedings. And this is so bizarre because they would take, you know, food. They say his diet included hummus, pasta, nuts, and raisins. They would puree that and pump it up his butt. Now, medical experts will tell you that putting food into somebody's rear end, it doesn't do anything. I mean, it doesn't go through the digestive tract backwards and confer nutrition on that person's system. And his lawyers accurately call it rape. So some of the worst torture occurred in May of 2003 when guards stripped him naked, hung him from a wooden beam for 3 days, gave him water but no food, and he was removed from the beam at one point to be examined by a doctor. And this is one of the issues that still needs to be worked out from our torture era. at medical doctors, psychologists, and psychiatrists were complicit in the torture regimes. And this doctor arrived to check his condition. Khan begged him for help. And instead, Khan says the doctor instructed the guards to put him back up on the metal bar for another 24 hours. And after that, he was forced to write a confession while being videotaped naked. Now, he says that he was not waterboarded in the typical manner, but that he was dunked into cold water tanks and held until he could not breathe. So it's a fine point. It's a kind of water torture that's different from the waterboarding that we've heard described in some detail. But it's another form of torture that our people used on these suspects. And today, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the legal representatives for Majid Khan, have issued this statement demanding that President Obama confront CIA torture once and for all by firing CIA Director John Brennan, releasing the full Senate report, ordering the Justice Department to investigate Khan's torture and the torture of other CIA prisoners, and prosecute those responsible for authorizing, implementing, and covering it up. I fully agree with the Center for Constitutional Rights. I want to applaud the kayaktivists in Seattle, who for several weeks now have been protesting around the big Shell drilling rig that is temporarily parked in Seattle. And I'm just getting around to a story that actually broke last week. But environmental groups were baffled after President Obama wrote a series of seemingly misleading tweets justifying Royal Dutch Shell being allowed back into the U.S. Arctic for exploration and drilling. So as you may know, Obama was recently given permission by his handlers to set up his own Twitter account and tweet personally. The White House used to do the tweets for him. So 2 weeks back, the Obama administration gave Shell the go-ahead to restart drilling in the Arctic region despite repeated warnings from environmentalists that it could very probably lead to a disaster. And there is a government report predicting that the likelihood of a spill in the next 77 years is about 75%. So Obama, using his recently acquired @POTUS Twitter handle, answered a question posed to him, why are you allowing oil drilling in the Arctic if you're concerned about climate change? So because you only get 140 characters, Obama split his response into three parts. One, we've shut off drilling in the most sensitive Arctic areas, including Bristol Bay. Two, but since we can't prevent oil exploration completely in region, we're setting the highest possible standards. And three, already rejected Shell's original proposal as inadequate, which shows we're serious. So when you break this down and you talk to critics, well, Shell on its own left the Arctic at the end of 2012 after mishaps and safety failures. Remember, one of their drilling rigs just was loose, adrift, and wound up slamming into the shore somewhere. Addressing the claim that oil exploration could not entirely be prevented in the region, a representative of Greenpeace said oil exploration in the U.S. Arctic could be halted, and the person who could do it is the president. He has the power as the executive branch. He is skirting around the issue, making it look like the decision is not in his hands when it is. Authorizing to allow Shell back into the Arctic was a May 11th statement by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is overseen by the president. Now, it's possible when Obama stated that oil exploration could not be prevented, he was referring to the entire region, which includes the waters that are held by other countries. But that's a real stretch. So, did he mistweet? It seems like it. But I want to commend Earth Justice because they have joined environmental groups and filed in U.S. federal court to challenge the leasing of the areas off Alaska's northwest shore to Royal Dutch Shell. And we'll follow this lawsuit and see if it produces the effect that the president says he cannot achieve on his own. We've gotten word from sources in Israel and the American Jewish newspaper The Forward that Sheldon Adelson is hosting a meeting of rich Zionists in Las Vegas this weekend. And they are going to develop a strategy and probably lay out large sums of money to counter the boycott, divestment, BDS, boycott, divestment, and I always forget what the S is, but you know what it is. At any rate, this is part of the effort where Israel pretends it is a victim of hateful people and anti-Semitic individuals who want to use their economic power and their free speech to deny themselves or others from doing business with Israel. And this has gained a lot of momentum, and Israel is clearly afraid of it. And they've set up organizations on campus to try to counter universities that have passed resolutions of BDS. The S stands for sanctions. I finally remembered that. And I reported to you last week that the governor of Illinois, the Republican governor, is poised to sign a bill which would make it illegal for the state of Illinois to do business with companies that honor the BDS call. And we have Senator Ted Cruz, who wants to cut off federal funding to universities who support BDS. And these efforts are so disgusting, so undemocratic. And they attempt to provide a veil of protection for Israel from criticism of its draconian treatment of the Palestinians. So we are told that we must shut up, and we cannot promote our view of human rights by exercising the First Amendment and our economic power and deciding we won't do business with the state of Israel as long as it pursues these inhumane policies. So the team is Adelson, Haim Saban, who is the Hollywood entertainment mogul. He had the animated show, some kind of Power Rangers. You can tell I'm out of touch with that. Also along with Israeli-born real estate developer Adam Milstein and Canadian businesswoman Heather Reisman. And they will be setting up a special task force to deal with increased calls on campuses to adopt measures of boycott against Israel. And finally today, I want to commend Bob Agelko. He writes about legal issues in the San Francisco Chronicle. And this is the only place I have seen this story. But he reports that Judge Stephen Reinhardt, a federal appeals court judge, has published an article in the Michigan Law Review about the execution at San Quentin here in California, 1998, of Thomas Thompson. Now, at issue here is that Thompson was tried separately from a co-defendant, and the prosecutors made substantially different claims about who committed a murder, and in pursuing the different versions of the story in the different court proceedings, clearly one was true and one was not. And so Thompson was convicted of raping and then killing a 20-year-old woman named Ginger Fleischley. And her boyfriend, David Leach, was tried separately and convicted of second-degree murder. But the same prosecutor gave conflicting versions of events at the two trials, telling Thompson's jury that he'd been the only one in the apartment with the woman, and then telling Leach's jury that Leach had been there and had ordered Thompson to kill her. Now, the differing versions also affect whether Thompson would have been eligible for the death penalty under California law because he claimed the sex with the woman was consensual, but in his trial, it was played up as rape. And that's the only reason he was eligible for the death penalty in this case. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco overturned Thompson's death sentence in 1997 because of these conflicting prosecutions. But the Supreme Court overturned that in a 5-4 decision in April of 98 on a technical issue because the appeals court had missed its deadline for reconsidering an earlier ruling. And at that, Thompson was executed at San Quentin. And Judge Stephen Reinhardt has written that the state of California, under order from the U.S. Supreme Court, likely executed an innocent man. That's my news and comment for today. You're authorized to share this with absolutely everyone. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.